Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Catholic Orthodox relations under the spotlight as the Vatican's top ecumenist travels to Moscow for talks with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch. Equal rights for women take centre stage on the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day. And Cyprus, a nation divided. Come with me on a journey to the disappearing village of Karpasha, struggling to preserve its ancient language, liturgy and cultural traditions. Head of the Vatican's Council for Promoting Christian Unity, Cardinal Kurt Koch, heads off to Moscow this weekend for a visit aimed at strengthening relations with the Russian Orthodox Church. The Cardinal, who took over his new job just a few months ago, arrives in the Russian capital on Saturday and will celebrate Mass in the Catholic Cathedral there. He'll also meet with Russian Orthodox officials, including Patriarch Kirill, who was elected to that top position 2 years ago. The visit comes on the heels of a high-profile meeting here in the Vatican in mid-February between Russia's President Dmitry Medvedev and Pope Benedict, a sign of the warming relations between Moscow and the Holy See. I spoke to the Swiss Cardinal just ahead of his departure to find out what hopes he has of a possible papal visit to Moscow. Cardinal Koch, tell us first of all what is on the agenda, what will be the highlights of this trip?
So in the first, I want to meet His Beatitude, His Holiness, the Patriarch, Kirill. That's for me very important to have a personal relationship with him. Then I will talk with the Metropolitan Hilarion. He's responsible for the relationship with other churches. And I hope that I can deepen the dialogue, the theological dialogue between the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church.
At what point would you say that dialogue is today? We have seen improvements over recent years. Where do you think we stand today in that relationship?
We have a long dialogue with the Orthodox Churches. In the first decade from 1890, we have deepened the human faith, sacraments, Eucharist, the mystery of church and the priesthood. And then in the second decade, there were a great problem between 90 and 2000 with the problem of the Uniatism and the proselytism, and this problem has finished the dialogue in 2000. And after a little time of the beginning of the pontificate of Benedict XVI, it was possible to do a new beginning with this dialogue, and we have made a very successful pass in Ravenna to 2007. Both churches have declared that the church is needed a protos on the local, regional and universal level. And now we will deepen this issue with a dialogue of the relationship between primate of the Bishop of Rome and the synodality in the church.
You mentioned that these improvements coincided with the beginning of Pope Benedict's pontificate. How much do you think, then, the figure of this particular pope is an important part of the improved relationship?
The first, it is a very kind friendship between the pope and the ecumenical patriarch in Constantinople. That has succeeded with this dialogue. I think the great question between our churches is the primate of the Bishop of Rome And just as Cardinal, our Pope, has said that for full communion between the Orthodox and the Catholic Church, the first millennium can be a very point of reverence, because the first millennium is common for our both churches, and the practice of the primate in the first millennium can give a basis for the future.
Pope Benedict is also seen by the Orthodox as a strong defender of moral and ethical values that they share, isn't he? I imagine that there'll also be discussions around this during your meetings.
That's clear that all societies in Europe are today in a very difficult situation by losing many values. They are constitutive for the European tradition, and the Church must help together to defend the necessary values for the humankind.
The Patriarch, also Hilarion, are people perhaps quite open to the idea of closer ecumenical relations?
That's a very good idea, that he has to have an alliance between the Orthodox and the Catholic Church for defending the values. But I think we must have more in our dialogue. We are on the way of a full communion between our two churches. And in this sense is needed a very deep dialogue between our ecclesiology.
When President Medvedev was here meeting with Pope Benedict just a few weeks ago, it was suggested that perhaps a longed-for papal visit to Russia might be on the agenda. What do you think about that?
That's a hope. And I hope that this is possible, but I can't give an agenda.
Cardinal Kurt Koch there, President of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. Across the globe, women do 66% of the world's work and produce 50% of its food. Yet they only earn 10% of its income and own just 1% of its property. Those rather depressing figures show just how far we still have to go in the struggle to achieve the genuine equality and empowerment of women worldwide, an objective set down clearly in the third Millennium Development Goal. Yet as we marked the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day this week, I found there is also much good news to share too, about women in all corners of the globe working to support those who still suffer from discrimination and lack of rights, from oppression, from violence, and from an inability to make their voices heard.
And they are all sources of hope, and I think we have to really support these women so that other women get this strength and can transmit it.
Martina Liepsch is International Policy Director for the Global Catholic Aid and Development Confederation, Caritas Internationalis, which has focused its efforts recently on the female face of migration.
This focus was chosen, in fact, by the General Assembly in 2007, and it was taking into consideration the fact that there are half of the worldwide migrants are women, and that so far we haven't seen very much policies taking into consideration their needs.
What particular needs do they have that don't get covered, for example, in general refugee and migration policy?
Well, first of all, I think we have to see that there are, let's say, the characteristics of migration with regard to women have changed. So over the past years, we have seen more migrant women migrating alone, not as companions of their families and their spouses. We have seen women who left their families behind, so they became breadwinners. On the other side, let's say at the receiving end, they were mainly entering into sectors which were not regulated in many countries, which means that they were subject to exploitation, to abuse.
There has been quite a lot more media attention, hasn't there, on this problem of women victims of sexual violence. Has this actually done anything to help resolve the problem, to try and stamp this out?
I think the issue of migrant women, the issue of trafficked women, women exploited, has come higher on the agenda. I'm not saying that we have a solution yet, but I think there are considerations around, for example, do a check of migration policies which look into the issues around women. You see, and that is specifically in the sector of domestic work, there are movements to regulate and recognize domestic work specifically, and I'm speaking not only about migrant women, but about domestic workers, because you also have locals performing this work. And so you have the initiative of the International Labour Organization, who will present a convention on decent work for domestic workers, including migrant domestic workers, at its next International Labour Conference in June, to ensure that domestic workers are recognized as workers, as other workers, that there are regulations around that, so the question of wages, the question of working hours, but then also considering the specific issues around migrant domestic workers who very often are recruited by agencies, which then ask very high fees, so that what they earn partly goes back to the recruitment agencies, that sometimes they are faced while leaving the country, they have a specific idea of what kind of work they're going to do, and when they arrive in the destination country, suddenly the work and the work contract is changed, the passports are taken away. So we are also asking to have a bigger control over, for example, recruitment agencies, but also put laws in place in the countries where these people work to regulate domestic work, for example.
Looking on a slightly broader perspective at Caritas's work more generally in terms of aid and development programs, it's often said that where women are the focus of aid and development programs, they're likely to work best. Do you share that assessment?
I think, generally speaking, yes. I think that there is a lot being said, for example, also in the work around climate change, about around food. There is a big part, for example, small-scale farmers who are women and who work to feed their families, practically. And there are also some statistics which also show you the other side of the coin, which say women perform 66% of the world's work, produce 50% of the food, but earn only 10% of the income and own 1% of the property. So there is still a lot to do. I remember colleagues in India, for example, who are fighting for the rights of women to be able to inherit what, in case they become widows, what their husband, the property of their husband, for example, because often when they become widows, they are practically without means. And definitely looking, for example, at the whole issue around food, and that will become a more pressing issue, I guess, over the next years. I think women do a great part of the work. So again, some statistics, and they say in some regions women provide 70% of agricultural labor and produce more than 90% of the food, but they are not represented many times in the budget deliberations, which would ensure that maybe their initiatives are also taken into account. So as I said, there is still a long way to go.
These are quite depressing statistics in many ways, aren't they? Can you give us something to share, something that we can celebrate on this International Women's Day?
Well, I think what we can celebrate for sure is that there are women working and very courageous, great women working in Caritas, but working also in other Christian and Catholic agencies who are really devoted to the situation of women. I think our conference in Senegal last year gave witness of that, so that you have women really close to other women who are in less favorable conditions. And for sure, I think we have to do everything to support these good colleagues and sources of inspiration for us in order for them to pass on this strength and motivation to others. So I remember, for example, a close colleague of mine working in Lebanon who has put together with her team, mainly women, has put all her efforts into providing laws for domestic workers. I have another colleague in Jordan who is very concerned about the health of migrant women and devotes a lot of her work, and that's not counting the normal working hours, but everyone puts a lot of heart in it and a lot of courage, sometimes under very difficult conditions. I remember my colleague working in Algeria who has to deal with stranded migrants, sometimes desperate conditions, and they are all sources of hope. And I think we have to really support these women so that, as I said, other women get this strength and can transmit it.
My thanks there to Martina Liebsch, International Policy Director for the Global Catholic Aid and Development Confederation, Caritas Internationalis. Holy Cross Church in the little village of Karpasha, Cyprus, is one of the most unusual places of prayer I've ever visited. Situated on the northern part of the island, occupied by Turkish troops since 1974, Karpasha is one of four remaining villages belonging to the Maronites, the largest Catholic community in Cyprus. Their ancestors migrated over from Lebanon and Syria during the Middle Ages, and the Maronite culture and religious traditions have maintained a significant presence on the island ever since. Today, however, less than a dozen people live in the once thriving village of Karpasha, while the nearby village of Asomatos counts only one nearly 90-year-old inhabitant. Visitors and family members are allowed across from the Greek side for 3 hours on Sunday, or with special passes to accompany visiting delegations, like the one I was travelling with from the Council of European Bishops Conferences. When visitors arrive along the narrow, dusty road that winds up into the Pentadactylos, or five-fingered mountain range, the bell of Holy Cross Church rings out and the inhabitants gather to welcome their guests. Inside the tiny church is a beautiful painted wooden crucifix, which miraculously survived both the bombings and the looting that destroyed a large part of the cultural heritage in this region. One by one, the visitors step up to the altar to venerate this precious icon, a poignant symbol of their own suffering and persecution down the centuries. Though fluent Greek speakers, the Maronites still use an ancient Aramaic dialect for their liturgy, a language which could disappear altogether unless some younger people are persuaded to return to these isolated villages.
We're a minority on the verge of extinction, and if nothing is done to avoid extinction, biologically people are old, non-young people, it will arrive to an end.
Among the most passionate defenders of this ancient culture is Dr. Petros Katsioloudis, who helps run a website called karpasha.com. He grew up in the village before going abroad to train as a doctor and now works at a hospital in Nicosia. He regularly returns to Karpasha to look after those in need of medical care and works tirelessly to preserve the history of his Maronite community.
The history is a very old history. It's the village is dated since the 9th century, since the arrival from the Middle East, from the Syria Magna, of the refugees of that time after the Arab persecutions. They arrived in Cyprus and they stayed in this area, all the area of the Pentadactylos mountain. And Karpasia was one of the village of the first villages that was inhabited upon the arrival of those refugees from the Middle East.
You, your family have been here for many years, have they?
Yes, I was born here. My parents live here. And I had to go away to study. I went abroad, study medicine, and then I came back to my island. And I came once a week or more to take care of the old people here if somebody is sick or something. So I come once in a while.
You were here in 1974,
weren't
you?
Yes, I was 4 years old at that time. And the time was, let's say, a little bit difficult. But we stayed here for 7 years until 1981. I finished elementary school, and then I had to go to the high school. So we had to leave, and then I went abroad to study. And at that time, during that period, it was very difficult because we were allowed to come back twice or thrice a year. So you can imagine the difficulties. But since 2004, since the, let's say, the borders, the frontiers were open, the situation is much more easier now. But unfortunately, people, very few people are left here, about 10 to 12 people, very old people, let's say older than 78 years old. You can imagine that is a biological extinction. We cannot come back, unfortunately, it's difficult. So you can imagine our drama, it's a tragedy, let's say.
It's a very emotional scene when you have people coming across here.
Yes, it's a rare, let's say, occasion. Rare occasions, people come. Sometimes Europarlamentarians come from the European Union and visit. Very few people, though. They don't often come back to visit us, let's say.
What about the church here? It contains one of the oldest icons,
yes,
doesn't it, on
Cyprus?
Yes, we
have, let's say, two crosses. The church is dedicated to the Holy Cross. The first one that you see over there, it's dated since the 17th century. And the other one, 15th, and the other one, 17th century. They are both Byzantine. Let's say style. The first one original Byzantine, the other one is Cypriot Byzantine variety. And also have other icons and also frescoes. This is Archangel Michael, dedicated to Archangel Michael. It's a very old church, but it's one of the few villages that have remained Maronite for Catholic, let's say, for many centuries, since the 8th century AD till today.
What kind of relationships? You say there are very few old people living here. Do they have contact with their Turkish neighbours here at all?
Yes, we do have, because the villages nearby were mixed villages. They are made up from Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots. So we used to have excellent relationship with our neighbours, let's say. And we still do. But as time goes by and people are getting older and older, you can imagine, even though we have good relationship, since nobody can come back, there is no, let's say, there is no future for us, because these people will gradually die. And I don't know if they will let us come back and live to our ancestral land.
What are your hopes? What is your wish for?
Our wish is to come back, to give life to our villages. And we're trying through this, through our church, through our political leaders, through the Vatican, to let us come back, because we're a minority on the verge of extinction. And if nothing is done to avoid the extinction, biologically, people are old, no young people, it will arrive to an end, let's say.
What kind of support do you hope to receive from abroad? I mean, people don't seem to be that interested in the Cyprus question.
Fortunately,
anymore.
Upon the arrival of the Holy Father on the island last year, it was a great opportunity, and it put into international, let's say, view our problem, our existence, because nobody knew that there are a few Maronite Catholic people living in Cyprus. Four of the villages, all of our villages are here. And fortunately, this brought our minority to existence, because people know now, through the arrival of the Holy Father and through the publicity, let's say, that was given to us through the arrival of the Holy Father, people are starting to know about us. And this is good, because now they're taking into consideration, they consider us, let's say, alive, that we exist. Before, nothing was possible. They thought just few thousand people, 5,000-6,000 people, without any. But we are part of this island. We are part of this, of the history of this island. We contribute to this island, to build this island, to build a democracy. We suffered through the many years of persecution, from the Arab persecution, let's say, into the Holy Land, through the persecution of the Ottoman Empire here. Most of our, let's say, ancestors are converted to Islam because they had no choice. So you can imagine, when the British arrived at the island in the 19th century, 1,000 people only remained in the island. You can imagine, and we're still fighting to survive. And I think we have the right to remain to our ancestral land. We have the right to come back and live once again to these villages. These villages are the nucleus, the core of our existence, because here are here's the place where we are born, our ancestors are born, and we live too long to lose it so suddenly. We lived here for over 12 centuries.
This village is open, people can come here. There are other villages which are closed, aren't they?
Yes, unfortunately, half of the, let's say, houses of the village are inhabited by military and their families. But they're not trouble, they're good people, they treat us well, they respect us, we have no problem. But we apply it so that they can be allocated elsewhere, so that the original, let's say, inhabitants of it can come back and once again live in their houses and once again give life to their houses. We just want to live, to co-live, coexist with our neighbors, have no problem with our Muslim neighbors, have no problem with our Orthodox neighbor, have no problem with anybody. We just want to live in peace, and this is our message. And we want to exist and to keep to our tradition, because our tradition is very old. The Maronite tradition is a very old Oriental tradition. It's part of the Oriental churches. You just know it better than me. And we wish to keep it as such. We are a little bit different, but difference and diversity is a good thing towards evolution, because if you have all people are equal, this brings to, let's say, a dead end. In biology, it's the same thing. When you have inbreeding, all the things become equal. That is death. So you can imagine the same in societies and in, let's say, the same happens everywhere. So we are trying to maintain our diversity and have respect for our diversity. And I wish people can understand this. The international community can have a glance to our situation. We don't want any war. We don't, let's say, complain. We don't say that it's the fault of the one or the other. We are not interested in politics. We just want to live in peace. This is our message.
My thanks there to Dr. Petros Katsioloudis, who helps to run the website karpatia.com. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.